This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina House Republicans are making their move on a voter ID law. The legislation would require photo identification from voters. Republicans say it's necessary to prevent fraud. Opponents say it's a modern-day poll tax. We'll hear about that and discuss the latest concerns about fracking. Plus, we're going to take a look at how college campuses are struggling to handle sexual assault cases in the wake of the controversy at UNC. With us here to talk about all of that is WRAL Capital Bureau Chief Laura Leslie. Scott Hewler is with us. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank.
Scott Hewler, journalist, blogger for Scientific American, author of the book On the Grid, and Mitch Kokai, director of communications at the John Locke Foundation. Great to have everybody here. Good
Thank
to have you.
Thank
Glad
you.
Glad to be here.
Laura, give us the background on the voter ID law. What do we know now about what the GOP is looking for? What do they want?
Well, we don't know much. I mean, basically what happened is they passed one in 2011 that required photo ID. And the governor at the time, Governor Perdue, vetoed it. And they were not able to get the votes to override that bill. So this is round two. We don't have a proposal on the table. We're not going to for a few weeks because the leadership has said they want to hold some public hearings. They want to get some input, hear from some panelists, some experts, and then they'll draft a bill. We'll see it around the end of the month. We don't know for sure what's in it. The position of the Republican caucus is that they want to have the photo requirement. And that's the issue that troubles a lot of the Democrats and the folks who are opposed to this bill. As they, you know, they say that there are a lot of people, potentially hundreds of thousands, of mostly elderly, predominantly minority, predominantly female and predominantly poor voters who don't have a government-issued current photo ID. They don't drive for whatever reason. And so, you know, that's at this point, what we know is the votes are there in both chambers to move it forward. So it's not a question of if, it's a question of what it's going to look like. And so the question is, you know, will the Democrats who've been invited to the table by the leadership actually be able to have input in trying to, as the Republican leaders put it, craft the best bill possible?
And we've heard from some Republicans in the Fayetteville area offered a proposal very recently that would, they think, solve the problem. Tell us about that proposal. A proposal by some Fayetteville Democrats that would, and I think
it occurred
in the Fayetteville Observer today, a suggestion that people could come to the polls if they didn't have a government-issued photo ID. They could get their picture taken, signed an affidavit that it's there, but you would do it at the polls. So a kind of provisional ballot, although I think it would count right away. Your vote would count. It wouldn't be provisional. But we would check out your story later, and if you weren't telling the truth, it would be a felony.
It does call to mind the question of where the equipment's going to come from at each of these polling stations, these precinct places, to have that happen. Unless you're going to put a photo booth in every precinct station, I suppose the state could if it wanted to, but it would be a significant expenditure of money. And one thing to note is that under federal law, I mean, if someone were to come in without an ID, they do have to let you vote. It's a provisional ballot, though, and in a lot of these cases, you would need to come back within a certain amount of time with some form of ID that they would recognize and could verify your identity. The question is how that all would work and whether or not that is unduly taxing to the people who may not have a driver's license in the first place. So, you know, there certainly are ways to have provisional ballots and ways to allow people to still vote. It's just a question of how the details work.
Mitch Kokai, we've talked about this before, but let's do it again. The whole point of this is to prevent voter fraud, but there hasn't been much voter fraud, particularly not when it comes to voter ID anyway, people who go to the polling places. Do we need this?
Well, the problem is in saying that there's not much voter fraud, we don't know. I mean, I don't think that anyone, even among those who are pushing this measure most vociferously, think that there is a ton of voter fraud where thousands and thousands of people across North Carolina are violating the law. What they're worried about is the handful of people who might think that because they could walk in and if they happen to know someone else's name and address, that they could go in, say they're that person, and cast a ballot. And the likelihood of this causing a massive change in the way people vote in North Carolina is not big, but it could play a role in these handful of elections that come down to just a few votes here and there. The idea, I think, that the Republicans have been pushing, and Laura and I were at the same news conference when they talked about this, is we want a law, we want to have a photo. If you were against this on principle, that's fine. But if you have some objections that we could address in the legislation and still have a photo ID, please tell us. We're happy to hear them. We're going to, instead of rolling out a bill and having it be passed within a few days, we're going to take about a month to get through this thing. So if you have ideas that would make a photo ID better, please tell us. we'll incorporate it if we can.
What the legislature is not addressing is the issue of absentee ballots, where we do know there's been fraud, more at least demonstrated than at the polls, and yet this isn't being addressed at all.
The mail-in, right.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, though, because that is one piece of this puzzle in which the House election law chairman, David Lewis, said they would like to address this issue. Because someone asked, is this going to be part of a larger piece of legislation that deals with a bunch of different election issues? And he said no, with the possible exception of absentee ballots, because that has been one of the issues that's raised, that if you're dealing with voter ID to address voter fraud, you ought to deal with the absentee issue. And he said, absolutely, if we're going to do anything else other than the photo ID, we would like to address this absentee issue. So I'm certain you're going to hear some suggestions on that front as well.
Right, which makes sense. I mean, because if you don't have a photo ID, or if you want to commit voter fraud, and that's the big loophole that's left, then that's where you're going to go, right? And what few there have not been a lot of cases of documented voter fraud in North Carolina, but most of them have involved mail-in absentee ballots, because there's no verification except for the signature, and who knows how carefully sometimes that's verified when it gets in.
Scott Hewler, you know, it's a pretty kind of a common sense argument. This is open to fraud. Why not just close the possibility of photo ID? Everybody can get one. Make it possible for everybody, rich and poor, to get one, and we have a pure election process.
What's I think a more common sense argument is, if you want to solve a problem, why don't you find a problem to solve? There's, you know, as we've all agreed right in here, in-person voter fraud is not a problem. People, progressives, fear legitimately that it's a stumbling block to people, as Laura said, older people, people on the edges in any number of, for any number of reasons, may not have that ID. So why put up more stumbling block? The question that you have to ask is, why is the law there? If Rich, you've agreed, we've all agreed, this isn't a problem to solve. This isn't a problem.
I don't think anybody said it isn't a problem, though.
Okay.
I think
maybe it's a problem, you know, a teaspoon-sized problem. Why are we hitting it with a backhoe?
When you look at the polls, though, there's a perception of a problem. Now, okay, but what I'm saying is, the argument that Republicans are making in this case is, if people are that concerned about it, why not take some common sense measures to restore their faith in the electoral system? Even, you know, whether or not, you know,
I'd rather educate the people to be concerned about legitimate problems than encourage them to be concerned about things that aren't problems by addressing their the false problems they're worried about.
On the hunch that something is going to go through along the voter ID, there's going to be some kind of voter ID law in the state of North Carolina. What should it look like? What would address those concerns to allow people who now find it difficult and don't have a photo ID to get one in a way that isn't going to break the bank? Mitch, what do you think it would look like?
I think that this issue of addressing the people who don't have the IDs is going to end up being much smaller than the critics have raised. I mean, we saw a report from the Board of Elections in North Carolina that suggested somewhere in the neighborhood of a 500,000 people might be on the voter rolls legitimately and not have a photo ID. They had a caveat in there that many of those are probably women who've been married and changed their names, and there could be some other things that would knock down that number. If you look at states that have already had a voter ID and have dealt with this exact same issue before, once they've put the law into place and then said, okay, we're going to give free IDs to anyone who wants one, doesn't have one now, please, you know, we're going to open up this process, it tends to be a few thousand people every year come and get the free ID. Georgia has had this in place for several years. Since they've passed theirs, it's been something like 25,000 people total over the course of 6 or 7 years have gotten the free IDs. That's probably what North Carolina will have to do. Most people who vote are going to have either the driver's license or the passport or anything else that has a government-issued ID. Those who don't can get this new free ID. It's not going to be as expensive as the critics have said.
Well, Laura, have you looked at this? And it seems to me the critics may have looked at this in other places to see how much of a barrier it really is for places where this law has been in effect. Do we know?
Well, we do know that in Georgia, after the law was implemented, they actually had greater turnout the next election. Now, part of that was the politics of the next election. Okay, so let's be fair. But I think one of the concerns that folks point out, you know, what Mitch was saying, you know, these few thousand come every year. How many people don't bother, or how many people don't have a way to get there to get the free ID decide not to vote?
The question isn't how many people get the free IDs. The question is how many people don't get the free IDs and then don't vote.
Yeah, and why don't they? I mean, they could.
And maybe they can't. Maybe they perceive that they can't. You're very concerned about people's perceptions. If they perceive that they can't, they're not going to do it. So once again, I think the question is, when there really isn't a problem, why are we working so hard to solve it? And you have to look at people's motivations. And if the people who we fear are going to be harmed by this are poor, are people of color, are immigrants who aren't sure what they can and cannot do, these are all traditionally democratic constituencies, it's very hard for people, for progressives, not to look and say, you're trying to solve this non-existent problem in order to make it difficult for people who don't agree with you to vote. And that's, if that's true, that's awful.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that Republicans have been the one pushing this. They're always the ones who've been pushing voter ID, but the idea has support across the board. I mean, basically, most of the polls say 70% plus. We know from all election results that there aren't 70% Republicans in North Carolina. So a lot of Democrats see this as a problem as
among voters. I've got 30 seconds left in the segment, Laura. What about in the legislature? Is there going to be much crossover Democrats who support this?
There'll probably be a handful who will, if their caucus allows them to. I mean, it does have an awful lot of support. It depends, again, on what it looks like. I mean, exactly what the details are, because the devil really is in the details and how this is going to work.
We'll see how it plays out, and we'll continue our conversation. WRAL Capital Bureau Chief Laura Leslie, Scott Hewler, journalist, blogger for Scientific America, author of On the Grid, and Mitch Kokai, the Director of Communications for the John Locke Foundation. Just ahead, fracking and the sacking of state commissioners and sexual assault at UNC, all on the Week in Review on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the week's news, and with us, WRAL Capital Bureau Chief Laura Leslie. Scott Hewler is a journalist and a blogger for Scientific American. He is the author of the book On the Grid. Mitch Kokai is the Director of Communications for the John Locke Foundation. Talking about voter ID in the past segment, I want to move on now to take a look at the various state commissions and boards in the state, a little bit of dissent or controversy within the legislature. House Republicans want to sack 100 members of various state commissions. The Senate has a different idea about how that should go. Laura, give us some background on this and what's going on.
The bill emerged kind of out of nowhere in a Senate committee a couple weeks ago, and it basically would clear out, more than 24 boards and commissions. Some would be eliminated. Others would simply be sort of, swept out, purged, and the legislature and the governor would have the ability to reappoint people that would be more in keeping with their philosophy, the Republicans, in other words, as opposed to Democrats. Not that everybody on a board is either or, but these are former appointees from Democratic administrations for the most part. Now, the Senate bill also would have gotten rid of 12 judges, which raise some eyebrows about whether or not you can do that with separation of powers constitutionally. The House took a slightly different approach. They backed off on some of this. They sort of made some of these sort of rollovers to keep some institutional knowledge on some of these boards. They got rid of some of the sort of what Democrats call more extreme proposals. But in the end, you're still talking about actually about 160 people being removed from boards and commissions. And about 90 of those people, at least according to Democrats, are folks who are looking at environmental impact of things and consumer interest in things. And they are going to be simply gone or replaced with people who have a background in industry.
As you said, it kind of came out of nowhere. What's the rationale?
Well, the rationale is, in one sense, the Republicans have been promising to reform government, to streamline government, to get rid. And there's a commission, to be fair, that has recommended that some of these boards and commissions be cut because they haven't met in who knows how long. You know, some of these do make sense to get rid of. And what the Senator Apodaca actually said is that, if we're going to hold the governor accountable, we need to let him have his people in place to run things the way he thinks that they should be run. Well, the Democrats are saying, we have never seen anything like this. I mean, in the Hunt administration, there were some people that were added to commissions, but there wasn't sort of this wholesale emptying out of the oversight boards and restocking them, and they say, this isn't getting rid of the old boy system. This is just inventing a new old boy system that favors the other side.
Now, they haven't seen it in a long time. And of course, these appointments have staggered timeline so
right.
that people are on, again, preserves institutional memory. But even so, in the past 100 years, they were all appointed by Democrats. So to
For
say
the
there
part.
Hasn't been wholesale change, there have been some Republican governors along the way. So you know, the idea that there hasn't been wholesale change suggests perhaps a continuity of government rather than continuity in philosophy.
That's true. And it's also true, you talk about the staggered terms, it's to preserve institutional knowledge. But it was also sort of intended to make sure that no one person, no one governor or no one legislature would have the power to just sort of stack this stuff. And that's the part that has the critics of this proposal, you know, upset, because the whole point was to sort of have these boards be above politics to some extent in the larger sense of things, that well, a person might get to appoint one or two or three people, but the other five people would, you know, would come and go.
Scott Hewler, how do you feel about this?
I think it's horrific. I think it's the night of the long knives. It makes absolutely no sense that, as you've both said, it's just taking the entire institutional memory and every person, it seems, who represents the interests of the people and the environment and just tossing them aside so that we can put on people. I think anybody, I should think that progressives, liberals want a conservative voice, want the opposite voice on their bill, because nobody wants to run ungoverned. Nobody wants to have...
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm speaking for myself, who very often appreciates an opposing position. You want... Look, the founding fathers created a government so that with balance of power so that it couldn't do too much too quickly. This is so much so quickly and so, in my opinion, irrational. It's just taking people who know things, taking people who understand things, and tossing them aside.
Well, but the voice of the people, as you suggest, which is being pushed aside, is also expressed in the election. These are people who were elected to office, and they're now putting into these boards and commissions people who represent a point of view that was validated at the polls. Is it fair to say the people's voice is being pushed aside in all this?
Yes, absolutely. This is traditionally, as you said, these are staggered terms. No one has ever done anything like this, walk in and just sweep people out because you want to put in your own guys. And especially when, yes, there's the election had the results it did, but nobody can say that there's an enormous majority of Republicans in the state. It's just the way the districts have been drawn. I mean, as people have brought forward time and again, there are more votes were cast for Congress in the state for Democrats, and we have a nine Republican and four Democrat congressional delegation. So be careful when you're talking about the voice of the people. What I think we're talking about is the good of the people, and the voice of the people doesn't always clamor for the good of the people. That's why we have these commissions, to protect the people from the people they've elected. That's the entire goal of these commissions. And to be elected, to have a majority and sweep all these people away, especially in things like the Public Utilities Commission and Senate Bill 10, they removed the state geologist from the Mining and Energy Commission. There's dead weight for you on the Mining Commission. The geologist, what good is he going to do? Right? We don't need that, dude. And so I think that this is a terrible practice that I hope cooler heads
will Mitch Kokai?
Well, I would agree with Scott that it's irrational, but mainly from the political basis. I mean, you take this step and you're basically guaranteeing then from now on, anytime you have a new administration, everyone who that new governor doesn't like is going to get swept out and new people will be in. Now, there may be an argument for that if you're going to have these boards, they ought to express the views that the administration and that the legislature who makes the laws have the same views as those groups of people. But if you're going to make that argument, then the next time that the voters of North Carolina decide that Democrats are going to run the General Assembly and going to have the officer living in the executive mansion, then don't be surprised when all Republicans are off the board, because people will say, you know, that sounds like kind of a good idea. I'm glad that you thought of it, and now I can employ it.
Well,
that's
there may
really
be
good
a good argument for it, and I know you're not making it, but there may be a good argument for it. But then it would undermine the theory of these boards and commissions, which is precisely to act as ballast against political whims and to allow for institutional memory to remain on the panel long after legislators come and go.
So there is
a theory that underlies this. That theory would have to change if the new argument.
Well, Frank,
and there
think-
are some Republicans who agree with that. I mean, it was, you know, there was a floor speech by Representative John Blest, who's a Republican from Guilford County, during this debate in the House, that said, you know, we need to be careful. We need to be careful about how we're using power here. You know, and I think, you know, there you can talk about the voice of the people, but North Carolina is not an extreme state in either direction. And there is such a thing as overreach. And I think that you know, that there are some Republicans who are, you know, beginning to be concerned about the perception of overreach because of, you know, this sort of unprecedented, you know, Republican leadership in all three branches. You know, what are they going to do with it? And you know, running away with a bit between your teeth is not what a lot of voters want to see happen.
How is this going to play out, do you think? This is dissent, now a conflict between the House and the Senate. Do you sense that the Senate is moving to a more moderate stand on this or
no.
not?
No. No, this is something we're going to see a lot of conflict between the House and the Senate all session, and we've already seen two or three bills in which they've sort of held each other up, and they've been at odds, and you know, it's barely even March, so I have no idea what the budget process is going to look like at this rate. But you know, that's the trouble when you actually have everything, then you own it, and then you start fighting with each other. This is what Democrats have been doing for the last century, you know, and the Republicans just haven't had as much practice at it yet. See, but they're doing it. So I don't know what's going to happen with this bill. I mean, you know, what I've been told is that the governor actually wasn't consulted when this bill was written, and that the Senate and the House had agreement on this. And then the House turned around and made changes after they talked to Governor McCrory. And the Senate was furious because they had been told that they had House agreement in this. And so this is, you know, this is what happens when you have one party rule. It's never easy.
The House bill, by the way, took the judges out of that.
Yes.
Of the mix too.
Yeah,
right?
It made a bunch of adjustments to it. It was a, you know, it put some environmental voices back on some boards, and you know, even the Democrats in the chamber applauded the House Republican leadership for what they saw as stepping back from some of the more extreme positions in the Senate bill.
And Scott, you've written that when you look at who is being taken out, and you already talked about the state geologist, that this points to a real kind of antagonism about science that comes from the state legislature.
Absolutely.
Antagonism towards
science. You know, the sea level bill was the most famous one, where the NC20 fought against the conclusions of the panel they had created about sea level rise over the course of the next century, and they didn't like it, so they encouraged the legislators to toss it aside, which they did. And this is it's institutional madness. The sea will not listen to us.
King Canute.
Yeah.
The King Canute law.
Right. And King Canute supposedly was trying to make a point that the sea was in charge. The people here do not seem to understand that point. It's a terrible thing. North Carolina, especially central North Carolina, where we have the good fortune to live, everything we have is the result of science, the result of these universities, the result of the Research Triangle Park, of companies like SAS, where these are scientists. These are smart math science people doing stuff that have created everything we have. We're on the radio now because of science. All of these things are science makes our world work. And to start tossing out science because it annoys you, it's a terrible policy.
Well, there's a fair amount of science involved in fracking. That bill is moving along. There had been a moratorium. No longer. There's now a question about what to do. It appears that fracking will go forward in the state of North Carolina, the legislation making its way through the legislature. And now a question about what to do with the spent fracking fluid that is used to extract the natural gas. It appears by some studies, these would be scientific studies, by the way, that the places where the gas is located may not be the place to store the spent fluid. So tell us a little bit about the controversy and what the legislature has to consider there.
Right. And this is Senate Bill 76, which has gone through the Senate. It's now in a House committee. What it would do, several things. Number one, and this is what upsets a lot of people who are opponents of fracking, the former law that they passed last year said that the Mining and Energy Commission would make up the rules for all this, and the legislature would get one last chance to vote it up or down on those rules before fracking would start. This would clear out that check and balance. This just says from now on, the Mining and Energy Commission is making the rules and we're going to move forward with it. Another thing that it would do is it made a small change in the law that would allow them to, as you say, to use deep injection wells, to re-inject below the surface of the ground water that's used in the production. It did say initially that they could already do that if they were doing research and development exploration, but this is production adds a whole much, much larger volume. So that's a real problem because, and as you say, in the areas where the shale rock is, those formations are simply not suitable, geologists say, to drill these deep injection wells. The area that would be suitable in the state would be the coastal plain. But we've seen in history back in, I think it was around 1970 in Wilmington, that they had some deep injection wells at that time for some industrial waste, some acid, and it ended up leaching all over the place because the ground out there is so porous. So it's actually not well suited for injection wells either. So the question is, okay, if you're going to let these people drill these wells and put this toxic brine in there, where are you going to do it? And are those communities going to share in the revenue, in the bounty that the communities that have the shale gas are presumably going to get?
Mitch Kokai, I wonder, let me put the question to you this way. Is the state of North Carolina moving ahead too fast on fracking, on permitting fracking?
No, I don't think so. But I do think what happens with this new legislation, Frank, is it's basically a clarification of what the legislature wanted to do last time. Basically, in the last session of the General Assembly, they said, we're going to go ahead with fracking. We're going to set up this Mining and Energy Commission. They're going to come up with rules, but North Carolina is going to be open to fracking. What I think they found after they passed that legislation, when people started going to this new Mining and Energy Commission and saying, what about this? What about this? What about this issue? They wanted to be clear, the legislature, the ones who actually get to make the final decision, that, hey, this group is going to come up with the rules, but we are going to have the fracking, and here's when it's going to happen. Here's a deadline. Mining and Energy Commission, come up with your rules before then. Now, you can object that they are going too fast, and I'm sure some in this room would say that they are, but it is the legislature's decision. That Mining and Energy Commission didn't exist before the fracking law. So they basically set these folks up because they are, to some extent, people with technical and scientific knowledge to come up with the rules. But it's the legislature's decision. And if you're mad about fracking, vote against them.
Scott, Schilder?
I guess as a progressive, I'm almost obligated to say this, but I say it freely. This is the end of the world. I think this fracking
I see.
Will make mountaintop removal coal mining look like building sandcastles. This is taking chances with our groundwater. This is taking chances with our water. Without water, nothing.
Now, Scott, I'm going to hold you to your own standard. What science do you have to suggest that the chance that you've just talked about will result in the catastrophe that you've envisioned?
Well, let's see. I happen to have brought with me a piece from Scientific American, a fine publication. You should pay close attention to it. That a ProPublica research said from late 2007 to 2010. More than 17,000 violations nationally. One well integrity violation was issued for every 6 deep injection wells examined. And those integrity violations vary, of course, but you have this stuff, which is not just salt water. It is salt water with carcinogens. It's special.
And you don't know what carcinogens are.
Exactly, because they don't like to tell you. This stuff comes out in other people's wells. This stuff comes out like artesian wells bubbling out of the ground. We just don't know. There's just too much about this process we don't know. And interestingly enough, we ought to do the science first, but no, we're in a hurry. We're going to frack first and do the science later. And as another scientist said, who is an engineer who worked for decades as a technical expert with the EPA's underground injection program, he said, in 10 to 100 years, we're going to find out that most of our groundwater is polluted. A lot of people are going to get sick. A lot of people may die. That's not the kind of thing you hear and then you say, okay, let's rush. That's the kind of thing you hear and you say, okay, let's wait.
Let's wait. Let's study. Let's find out more. Mitch, let me ask you about this, because it is true that the ingredients of this solution are proprietary, and the people who make it say, we're not going to tell you what's in it. And we're going ahead anyway. And if you go back to the voter ID argument, isn't it common sense that people should really verify who they are when they come to the polls? Haven't had much evidence of fraud, but it's common sense to make that check. Wouldn't it be common sense to say, before we go forward with this, we need to know exactly what's in that solution before we agree, particularly when so many violations have been reported across the country, before we say, yes, go ahead with this?
Well, I think one of the issues to keep in mind on this, Frank, and I am not a scientist, wouldn't pretend to be one, but my understanding is that the bad stuff with fracking is from what comes out after you've done it. I mean, you don't have to put the bad stuff in. It's the bad stuff that comes out once you drill. So knowing what they're putting in there may be helpful, but probably is not going to be as helpful as knowing what comes out after the fracking is done. People
but we have to take their word for it to know that it's not bad stuff. I mean, that's my problem.
And I should add also that there actually is a stakeholder study group that has been listening to this kind of stuff and making recommendations to the Mining Energy Commission, and Assistant Dean or Secretary Mitch Gillespie tossed out half of the recommendations. And the chairman of the board said these people are not scientific and they're not experts, so we don't have to listen to anything that they say. And one of the recommendations was to require disclosure at least to emergency management officials on scene in case of a spill of exactly what class of chemicals.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say the stuff that goes in isn't bad if we don't know what it is. That's I guess, my question to you.
Sure, and I
have
really
to know that before we can be comfortable saying it's not that bad.
But they're telling you not to worry. So just don't worry.
But in some wells, they've been using diesel some places. Diesel fuel to frack. I mean, that's definitely not something you want in your groundwater.
So maybe we could take just a little more time.
And I really wouldn't have a problem if there is some concern about the trademark or whatever they're using, make sure that the state agency knows the information and that someone has it. I don't think that would be a problem.
You know what? The companies tell us that they promise it's okay. I think instead of believing that, we should get the other companies to promise not to listen when each company tells what's in their stuff. And it's the same kind of thing. We'll trust their promises and it'll be fine.
And I'm glad the governor of Colorado hasn't listened to this, because he drank some of that stuff that they use for fracking and said, hey, it's fine.
So far, so good. Yeah. Thank you all for being on the program today. Mitch Kokai, Director of Communications for the John Locke Foundation. Scott Hewler, journalist and author of the book On the Grid, blogger for Scientific American. And Laura, that occult magazine, right. Scientific American. And Laura Leslie, WRAL's Capital Bureau Chief. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, you guys.
Just ahead, the music of the Gary Brunati Jazz Trio, live on the State of Things. Stay tuned.